Well, good morning, everyone. When we started this sermon series a few weeks ago, I told you a story and I gave you an image of a father playing with his daughter. I encouraged you in this 21 days of prayer that we were in the month of January, in the same way that a young girl would approach her daddy in play, enjoying a warm and loving relationship with him and fully confident of his love for her, fully confident of his care for her. And I realized as I thought more about that this week that you're more likely to approach God in that way if you're deeply convinced of several things. If you're deeply convinced that God is present, you're more likely to turn to God in your circumstances. If you're deeply convinced that God knows you, knows your circumstances and hears your prayer, that God listens to you and hears your prayers, you're more likely to pray. If you're deeply convinced that God loves you, like we've been talking about this morning, that God truly loves you and wants what's best for you. If you are deeply convinced that God is always working in loving and constructive ways, that he's always building up. If you're convinced that nothing is impossible for God, if you're convinced that God will provide for you, if those things are in the background of your life, of your awareness, of your mindset, you're far more likely to be able to trust God like a little girl trusts her dad. And that image has been in the background for each of the sermons in this series and as we've talked about prayer together. Because I think if you're deeply convinced of those kinds of things, you're much more likely to focus on seeking the kingdom of God above all else. You're much more likely to trust that God will care for you. You're much more likely to listen for God's voice. And you're much more likely to be able to wait for him when he doesn't answer your prayer as soon as you'd like him to. In order to help shape our thinking about waiting this morning, we've been singing about that as we're thinking about it. In order to shape our thinking about it, I want to walk you through the story from John 11 that we just heard, the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. And I want to tell it as a story in four acts, think of it like a play. We'll have four acts in the play. The chapter is actually pretty long, and so what they read for us was just excerpts from that story. You might want to read the whole thing, but I'm going to highlight the four acts of the play that they might have read for us this morning. And as I do so, some of the insights I mentioned I'm going to take from Rebecca McLaughlin's excellent book called Confronting Christianity. She has a book, it's a book on apologetics, an excellent resource, and some of the insights will come from that book. So in this story that we have this morning, we have three main characters other than Jesus. We have Martha and Mary and Lazarus. Two sisters and a brother who live together just over the hill to the east of Jerusalem in the town called Bethany. And these three were pretty close friends of Jesus. It seems that whenever he was in town, whenever he was in Jerusalem, he often stayed with them, close friends that he stayed with. So in Act 1 of our play, you might say, Act 1 opens when Lazarus becomes sick. Lazarus is sick. And it must have been pretty serious because according to the text, he died from this sickness within just a few days. It didn't take long, and Lazarus died. But when he gets sick, Mary and Martha know what to do. I mean, after all, they have a close friend, close family friend who's a miracle worker. They have a close family friend who has healed many diseases and helped many people. In fact, as far as we could tell, maybe dozens and dozens or hundreds of people that he's healed, including men and women and children, all kinds of sicknesses and diseases. He's healed strangers, and he's even healed long distance. People who weren't in his physical presence, he was able to heal them. So very naturally, verse 3, it says, the sisters sent word to Jesus saying, Lord, the one you love is sick. Now, they must have known that something fairly serious was happening. Like I said, they might have said something like, he's deathly ill. Because he only lived a few more days. Verse 5 says that Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. He felt close to them as well. These were special friends in his life. But if you have your Bible in front of you, you'll notice that verse 6 says something you don't expect. It says that, verse 5 says, Jesus loved them. And so verse 6 says, so when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he jumped up and made a beeline for Bethany. No, that's not what it says. It says, so when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. He stayed where he was 2 more days. It says, so when. There's a cause and effect situation there. He loved them, so when he heard his friend was sick, he stayed where he was. Some of his closest friends reach out to him about a deathly illness, and so he waits. It's like Jesus responded by saying, by putting him on hold, you know, your estimated wait time will be only 2 days. I know you're deathly ill, but your estimated wait time, only 2 days. You know, we talked about this kind of thing two weeks ago in the sermon on trust, that sometimes when we call out to the Lord in our agony, we call out to the Lord through our tears, he doesn't come. We feel like he's not listening. We feel like he's put us on hold. And we don't really know what's happening. Maybe you've had that experience. Maybe that's something you're walking through right now, where you cry out to God, but you aren't immediately healed, or you ask God to sort out a problem you're having with someone else, or to help you sort it out, and nothing changes. Or you ask God to relieve the pain of a loss that you've suffered, but it still hurts like crazy. You know, it's interesting that Jesus himself had a similar experience in the garden on the evening before he was arrested. He cried out to God in agony in his prayer, paraphrasing his prayer, something like, Lord, if there's any other way to do this, please let's change the plan. If there's any other way to bring this about, could we please change the plan? And again, the next day when he's on the cross crying out to God, my God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why is this playing out this way? So Jesus could have jumped into action as soon as he heard from Martha and Mary. He could have at least sent word to them to say, I'm on my way. Or he could have sent word, like he did in Matthew 8, to the centurion whose servant was sick. The centurion came to Jesus and said, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come into my house. Just say the word. All you have to do is say, I know that all you have to do is say the word and my servant will be healed. And Matthew 8 says his servant was healed the moment Jesus said that. The moment Jesus said that, his servant was healed. So in Act 1, we ask ourselves, what is Jesus thinking? What, we trust him. I mean, he's Jesus after all, but why would he wait in a situation like this? It doesn't really make any sense to us. So let's go on to Act 2. Act 2, when Jesus finally arrives in Bethany. When he gets there, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. So think about this if you're Martha and Mary. I mean, you and I know how the story ends. We just read it again this morning, and for some of you, you knew this story before. So we know how the story ends, but they're in the story. They don't know how it ends. And Jesus comes to them 4 days after his death. Jesus didn't just wait 30 minutes. He didn't just wait 4 hours to give them an object lesson in patience and trust. He didn't just pause, like, you know, I'm going to heal them, but oh, let me just pause and see how they react. No, it wasn't like that. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. So their sorrow is real. Their grief is real. Their dismay at his death is real. I mean, we don't know the details of their family situation, but they were living in it. There's no mention of husbands for Mary and Martha. They're living in a time when the men in the household are usually the main providers, if not the only providers. And so maybe they're looking at a really uncertain future in the wake of Lazarus's death. And after 4 days, they're slowly coming to grips with the new reality of what their lives are going to look like without Lazarus in their family. So Jesus finally arrives in Bethany. Martha goes out to greet him, to meet him. She welcomes him. She believes that Jesus is the Messiah. She knows that he can heal and restore. But I think she's struggling to connect the dots between her expectations of who the Messiah would be and who Jesus actually is, or the things that he's actually doing. He doesn't completely fit the profile that she has in mind, as is true in many of the stories in the New Testament, the Gospels. And you can almost hear her saying, I want to believe, I do believe, I want to believe, but I don't understand how the pieces fit together. Please help me. Please help me fit the pieces together. And so she says to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But she also says, I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus says, your brother will rise again. And she answers, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus says to her, I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? And she says, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. So again, I think Martha is still saying, things aren't working out the way I hoped they would, but I believe they will eventually. And maybe with her, you would say, I trust you, but I don't understand you. I think Jesus gets that a lot. I trust you, but I don't understand you. I mean, you and I might say, we know that Jesus is going to eventually restore all things to the way they were meant to be, to the way they should be. But what about my pain today? What about the pain that I'm suffering with, that I'm struggling with in this moment? What is he going to do about that? And notice that Jesus' answer to her isn't probably the one that we would think of. His answer to her is, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Notice what he does not do, at least not yet. He's not comforting her. He's not making any move toward the miracle that we know is coming. She doesn't, but he's not immediately fixing her problem. He's not even immediately comforting her. He isn't really taking an action. His first step is to ask her, do you understand that your greatest need is not to have your brother back? Do you understand that your greatest need is to have me? Is to be in relationship with me? Will you keep your focus on me in the face of your suffering? Even in the face of death, will you keep your focus on me? Do you trust me, even with all those unanswered questions swirling around in your life? Do you believe that I am life itself? His first step is to draw her into relationship with him, to properly orient her to himself. He reaches out to her in her suffering, while she's still suffering. He hasn't fixed anything. He reaches out to her in her suffering to remind her that, as Nikki said last week, when she asked God what he wanted from her, if you remember that part of her sermon, what did God say? Her sense was that God said, what I want from you is you. What I want from you is you. And I think that's essentially what Jesus is saying here to Martha. Do you trust me even in your pain? Even with your pain, while you're in the midst of your pain. And Martha has the chance to say, yes, Lord, I do. It's kind of a, I believe, help my unbelief kind of statement in this case. Act 3, Mary joins them. Martha's sister Mary joins them for Act 3. And the most extraordinary thing happens. Probably the thing that, I don't know who would have expected this, but Jesus experiences their pain with them. He enters their pain. He shares in their grief. He's still not healing Lazarus. It says in verse 33, when Jesus saw Mary weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. They said, come and see. And Jesus wept. Jesus was so deeply moved and so troubled that he wept. What does that mean in this case? I mean, I think it's a little bit confusing if you stop and think about it. In the first place, Jesus could have prevented all of this pain and all of this weeping, all this grief by coming earlier, couldn't he? by healing his friend. If he had come right away, like Mary and Martha both said, basically, if you had come sooner, none of us would be crying, because he would have been healed. We know you would have healed him. And secondly, it seems the way the story is unfolding that Jesus already knows that he's about to heal or about to raise Lazarus from the dead. He knows that's coming. So why is he weeping if he knows he's just about to reverse a death? I mean, if you or I showed up somewhere knowing that we had a miracle in our back pocket, especially a whopper like this one, would you come in? You know, I mean, we would come in hot, wouldn't we? We'd come in excited. We'd come in, step back. I'm here. I got this. You know, prepare to be amazed. And even if you didn't say that out loud, out of respect for the people, you'd probably be thinking that, wouldn't you? I mean, you'd come in excited. But it says here that Jesus is deeply troubled and moved to the point of weeping. The Greek phrase that's translated here in the New International Version, he was deeply moved in spirit, is translated differently in the New Living Translation and some others. In New Living, it says a deep anger welled up within him. That's kind of interesting. A very different kind of translation. A deep anger welled up within him. And that's because the Greek verb here has the connotations of both anger and grief. There's an anger component to this being deeply moved that isn't quite picked up in the NIV. I mean, we would have loved in a situation like this for Jesus to stop and explain what he was thinking or what he was feeling, or maybe for John as the narrator here of the story to tell us. Sometimes, you know, these kinds of tidbits are scattered throughout the Gospels that give us insights into what people are thinking and feeling. But we don't have that in this case. All we know is that Jesus had a strong emotional reaction and that he wept with his friends. So probably some mixture of grief and anger. Commentators wrestle with this. If you read commentaries on this, you'll see them trying out different ideas, different explanations. Anger would probably be the result of the pain and the sorrow caused by sin and death and sickness and death in this case. Angry at how this hurts people. Maybe grief about the same thing. Grieving that sin and death cause so much pain in our lives. Or maybe he was angry that the mourners were so despairing, that if they seemed so despairing. Apparently it was the custom in the time to pay people to come and help you keep up your mourning, to mourn with you and to kind of energize the mourning, to lead you in sad songs and to wail. And maybe Jesus was angry at that in this case. I don't know. But I think there's an important lesson for us in this part in Act 3. And that is that Jesus knows the end of this story in John 11. Jesus knows the end of this story, just like he knows the end of your story and he knows the end of my story, or he's promised us resurrection and new life. He's promised to wipe every tear from our eyes. And yet, he also enters the heartbreak of our suffering with us in the meantime. Did you ever think about it that way? Jesus knows the end of the story. He's the one whose life and death and resurrection have brought that about, the one who's made those promises. And yet in the meantime, he enters with us in the heartbreak of our own suffering. He weeps with us when we weep. He grieves with us when we grieve. He's angry with us when we're angry about pain and injustice. He knows the pain we experience in suffering from his own experience with it. Isaiah, who wrote 700 years before Jesus lived, was looking ahead in Isaiah 53 when he was describing the one who was to come, and he said, he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. That's quite a phrase. The one who is to come is going to be one who is familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised and we held him in low esteem. Surely he looked upon our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And the punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds we are healed. By his wounds, we are restored to proper relationship with God. So Jesus is the one person who knows all of our heartache and all of our pain from experience. He endured it. He didn't fight it. But it's clear he didn't enjoy it either. Just like you and I don't enjoy it. Even though we know it, when we know it's working good in our lives, we don't enjoy pain at all. It made him angry. He grieved and he cried out for relief from God, just like you and I do. Jesus is the one who comes to us in compassion and who shares that pain with us, who weeps with us. So in Act 1 of our story, Jesus waited to come until it was too late. In Act 2, he drew Martha into a deeper relationship with himself, telling her, "I am the resurrection and the life." And in Act 3 of our story, the one who is the resurrection and the life wept with his friends in their heartache and in their pain. And so finally we get to Act 4, where Jesus finally approaches the tomb. Jesus finally approaches the tomb, has the stone removed. He says a brief prayer, and then he shouts, "Lazarus, come out! Lazarus, come out!" I'm guessing that people watching were a little puzzled when he walked toward the tomb. Probably the custom of the time was to gather in the house with the family, to mourn with, to comfort the sisters and any other family who were gathered there. And he's walking toward the tomb saying, "Remove the stone?" And they're thinking, "What?" As Martha says, "It's going to smell bad. He's been in there for 4 days. He's not unconscious. It's long enough to be sure that he's not unconscious, that he's dead." And yet Jesus approaches the tomb, "Lazarus, come out." And then Lazarus stumbles out, wrapped up in his grave clothes. And Jesus says, "Release him. Release him. Let him go." Brothers and sisters, this is a foreshadowing of what will happen for us one day. Maybe after you and I have been long forgotten by the people around us, but not by Jesus. Jesus will call us out of our graves, not to float around like disembodied spirits, but to be raised to life in new resurrection bodies and to walk on a restored earth as part of the restoration of all things. The resurrection and the life himself will call us to life, because his victory over death is complete, because his power over death is absolute. Thanks be to God. And that's Act 4. Jesus raises Lazarus as a precursor of his own resurrection and of our own. A foreshadowing. So what do we make of all this? We're still left with some kind of interesting questions and wondering how we tie the pieces of this kind of strange story together. I mean, why, if Jesus was going to release if he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead anyway, why did he let him die? And then why did he wait and let everyone go through the trouble of burying him and the pain and the grief of mourning him? Isn't that a lot of bother? Couldn't he have spared them a lot of trouble by not waiting? And why didn't he just heal Lazarus right away? Why did he wait to do that? And why didn't he, when he first got to Bethany and he was greeting Martha and Mary, why didn't he comfort them? Why did he wait? Why didn't he just comfort them and say, "Look, in just a few minutes, I'm going to raise him from the dead. This is all going to be fine," you know, that kind of thing. Why did he wait? Well, that's why you have an epilogue in a play or in a book, right? You have an epilogue to kind of tie the pieces together and explain to you what was going on. We don't know all of what was in Jesus' mind, but I think Rebecca McLaughlin helps us very much when she says in her book, "In this strange stretching of the story," in other words, the including of this waiting period, stretching the story out to include this waiting, "we get a glimpse of the whole biblical framework for suffering. The space between Lazarus' death and Jesus calling him out of the tomb, those 4 days, that is the space of waiting, the 4 days of waiting, that's the space in which Martha sees Jesus for who he really is. Her very life. She comes to understand in a new way that Jesus himself is her life. And what if the waiting period between the beginning of your and my pain and its ending, what if the time of our waiting for him is one of our best opportunities to deeply understand who Jesus really is? That Jesus really is our life. that nothing else is our life in the way that Jesus is our life. You know, we often think of prayer as a means to an end. In other words, we think of prayer as a tool we use to get something or to get something done. And that's part of what prayer is. We're invited and instructed repeatedly to pray along those lines. But I think this story that we've looked at this morning helps us to see clearly that Jesus is not mainly a means to an end. He's not mainly a tool for helping us get what we want or get done what we want to get done. Jesus is the end of our prayers. Jesus is the end of our prayers. And I think we see that in this story. We see Martha having a chance to understand that in a fresh way. Friends, all of our circumstances, all of what happens to us in our lives, waiting or not waiting, all of those circumstances are meant to point us, to turn our attention to Jesus. Everything that happens to us, good or bad, happy or sad, will point us to Jesus if we will let it. If we will let it. We know that our deepest friendships are more deeply formed or as deeply formed by the pain and the suffering that we walk through together as they are by the happy times that we share together. That's true in our deepest friendships. It's true in our marriages. When we weather challenges together, those things draw us together like nothing else. And so too in our journey with Jesus. The point, I think, of this waiting is finding him. It's turning to him in our suffering, enduring it with him, together with him. How different would your life be if that were your perspective on your life? Can you imagine how differently you would face the circumstances of your life? How would it change your outlook this coming week if you go into this week thinking, no matter what happens to me, it's going to turn my attention to Jesus. Everything that happens to me, or with the mindset that everything that happens to me deepens my relationship with Jesus if I will share it with him. Everything that happens to me, no matter good or bad, stretching or not stretching, everything that happens to me deepens my relationship with Jesus if I share it with him. Then we can join Paul as he says in Romans 8, we wait with eager hope for the day when God will give us our full rights as his adopted children, including the new bodies he has promised us. We wait patiently and confidently. And we can do that. We can wait patiently because you and I understand from our experience that no matter what happens to us, God is present. That no matter what happens to us, God listens to us. Hears our prayers, that no matter what happens to us, God loves us. God truly wants what's best for us, what's truly good for us, that no matter what happens, God is always working in loving and constructive ways, even when we can't see what he's doing, we don't understand what's happening, that no matter what, we realize, we were deeply convinced that nothing is impossible for God, and that no matter what happens, we hold on to the truth that God will provide for us. And so we can wait patiently and confidently for him to work. As our final step today together, I want you to, if you have a little green sheet that you picked up on your way in, I want to turn your attention to that as an action step both for today and for the ending of this whole sermon series that we've been in for the last 4 Sundays. I'm going to fill in these blanks for you, and what I want to invite you to do is to take this with you and to prayerfully consider each of these pledges. These are each worded as a pledge. I will do this. I will do that. I want you to prayerfully or thoughtfully consider these and then mark yes or no. You may not be ready to make any of these pledges. You may be ready to make some and not others, but I just invite you to use this as a tool to focus your attention on Jesus' presence and work in your life and to sort out where you're at with him. So the first one, I will focus on seeking the kingdom of God above all else. I will focus on seeking the God above all else. If you want to think more about that, you can go back and listen to the first sermon in this series. Number two, I will trust that God knows what I need and will provide for me. I will trust that God knows what I need and will provide for me. Number three, I will listen for his voice. I will listen for his encouragement. I will listen for his guidance. And number four, I will wait for Jesus. I will wait for him in gratitude. I will wait for him in faith. I will wait for him in confidence. And then you might get caught in that last phrase, no matter what. If you're not ready for that phrase, I guess you could cross that one out and think, I'll get there sometime.